During the War for Independence itself, most of the 36 little weekly newspapers in the colonies took the Patriot side and mobilized resistance by giving space to anti-British letters, news of Parliament's latest outrages, and calls to action. But the clarion, journalistic voice of the Revolution, was my hero, the one-time editor of the Pennsylvania magazine, Tom Paine, a penniless recent immigrant from England. A penniless recent immigrant from England, where he left a trail of failure as a businessman and a husband. In 1776, just before enlisting in Washington's army, he published Common Sense, a hard-hitting pamphlet that slashed through the legalisms and doubts to make an uncompromising case for an independent and republican America. It's been called the first bestseller, with as many as 100,000 copies bought by a small literate population in the colonies. He followed it up with another convincing collection of essays written in the field and given another punchy title, The Crisis. Passed from hand to hand, reprinted in other papers, they spread the gospel of freedom to thousands of doubters. And why I bring Tom Paine up here in Madison, Wisconsin tonight is because he had something we've got to restore. He had a resolve to reach ordinary people with the message that they mattered and that they could stand up for themselves. He couched his gospel of human rights and equality in a popular style that any working writer can envy. As it is my design, he said, to make those that can scarcely read understand, I shall therefore avoid every literary ornament and put it in language as plain as the alphabet. That plain language spun off memorable one-liners that we're still quoting tonight. These are times that try men so. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Remember that. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. Virtue is not hereditary, even if your father was president. And I like this. I think of my father, fourth grade education, voted in every election, took it seriously, read the newspaper from front to cover, the little newspaper in Marshall, Texas. Of more worth, said Thomas Paine, is one honest man to society, he would say womankind, and in the sight of God, more worth than all the crowned ruffians that ever lived. I don't know what Paine would have thought of political debate by bumper sticker and soundbite, but he could have held his own as Dutch Circle's running mate. And of course, since they knew each other, there were also editors who felt responsible to audiences that would dive deep. I mean, this is unbelievable. In 1787 and 88, the little New York Independent Advertiser ran all 85 members of the Federalists, numbers of the Federalists, those serious essays in favor of ratifying the Constitution. They still shine as clear arguments, but they are and they were unforgiving in their demand for concentrated attention. Nevertheless, the Advertiser felt that it owed the best to its readers. It trusted its readers, and they trusted him. And the readers knew that the issues of self-government deserved their best attention in return. I pray that our media reform movement includes the press as conscientious as the New York Advertiser, as pungent as Common Sense, and as public-spirited and resolute as both. It will take it. Because remember, what the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Back in 1791, when the First Amendment was ratified, the idea of a free press seemed safely sheltered in law, but it wasn't. Only 7 years later, in the midst of a war scare with France, Congress passed and John Adams signed the infamous Sedition Act. The Act made it a crime. The Act made it a crime to circulate opinions, quote, tending to induce a belief that lawmakers might have constitutional or repressive motives, or, quote, directly or indirectly tending to justify France or to criminate, whatever that meant, president or other federal officials. No wonder opponents call it a scheme to excite a fervor against foreign aggression only to establish tyranny at home. John Ashcroft would have loved it. But let me tell you what happened. A dozen editors refused to be frightened and went defiantly to prison, some under state prosecution. One of them, Matthew Lyon, who also held a seat in the House of Representatives, languished for 4 months in an unheated cell during a Vermont winter. But admirers chipped in to pay his $1,000 fine, and when he emerged, his district reelected him by a landslide. Such was the spirit of liberty abroad in the land at the time. Luckily, the Sedition Act had a built-in expiration act date of 1801, at which time President Jefferson, who hated it from the first, pardoned those remaining under indictment. So that story has an upbeat ending, as ours may well have. But it will, let me be honest with you, it will take the kind of courage that those early printers and their readers showed. Courage is a timeless quality and surfaces when the government is tempted to hit the bottle of censorship again during national emergencies, real or manufactured. As so many of you will recall, in 1971, during the Vietnam War, the Nixon administration resurrected the doctrine of prior restraint from the crypt and tried to ban the publication of the Pentagon Papers by the New York Times and the Washington Post, even though the documents themselves were a classified history of events during four earlier presidencies. Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the Times, and Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Post, were both warned by their lawyers that they and their top managers could face criminal prosecution under espionage laws if they printed the material that Daniel Ellsberg had leaked. And by the way, which Ellsberg offered to the three major television networks without success. But after internal debates and the threats of some of their best-known editors to resign rather than fold under pressure, including Ben Bagdikian, who is here this weekend, both owners gave the green light and were vindicated by the Supreme Court. Score another round for democracy. Bipartisan fairness, however, requires me to note that the Carter administration in 1979 tried to prevent the Progressive magazine, published right here in Madison, from running an article called How to Make an H-Bomb. The grounds were a supposed threat to, quote, national security, but Howard Moreland had compiled the piece entirely from sources open to the public, mainly to show that much of the classification system was Wizard of Oz, smoke and mirrors. I remember when I was in the White House with Lyndon Johnson, we asked for the Pentagon to send us over the stories about Vietnam from the previous month. They came over, all right, by messenger in a truck, big packages of newspaper clippings wrapped in brown paper marked, stamped, top secret. But in the case of the Progressive, the courts again rejected the government's claim. It's noteworthy that the journalism of defiance by that time had retreated to a small left-wing publication like the Progressive. In all three of those cases, confronted with a clear and present danger of punishment, none of the owners flinched. right here. Name one executive of today's big media conglomerate likely to show the kind of resistance that Sulzberger, Graham, and Irwin Noll did. Not Robert Wright of General Electric. He took Phil Donahue off NBC because the network didn't want to offend conservatives in Washington. Then MSNBC gave a show to Michael Savage, whose diatribes had described non-white countries as third world nations and gay men and women as part of the grand plan to cut down on the white race. Now, this is what struck me as odd. The GE NBC team had to calculate that while Donahue was offensive to conservatives, Savage wasn't. Not Michael Eisner. He told NPR he didn't even want ABC News, which Disney had bought, reporting on its parent, Disney. And certainly not Leslie Moonves, the head of CBS. In the very week that CBS was celebrating its 75th anniversary, taking kudos for its glory days as the Tiffany Network, unafraid to broadcast the harvest of shame and the selling of the Pentagon, the network's famous eye blinked. Pressured, as Congresswoman Slaughter said, by a vociferous and relentless right-wing campaign and by the Republican National Committee. You should read that letter that the RNC sent to CBS. And at a time when its parent Viacom has billions of dollars resting on whether the White House, Congress, and the FCC will allow it to own even more stations, CBS caved in and pulled the miniseries about Ronald Reagan that conservatives thought insufficiently worshipful. Moonves says taste, not politics, dictated his decision. But earlier this year, explaining why CBS had planned a series about Adolf Hitler, Moonves sang a different tune. Quote, "If you want to play it safe and put on milk toast, then you get criticized," he said. "There are times when, as a broadcaster, you take chances." Well, this wasn't one. Granted, made-for-television movies about living figures are about as vital as the wax figures at Madame Tussauds, and even less authentic. Granted that the canonizers of Ronald Reagan hadn't even seen the film before they set the howling. Granted, on the surface, it's a silly tempest in a teapot. Still, when a once great network falls obsequiously to the ground at the feet of a partisan mob over a cheesy miniseries no one would have taken seriously, you have to wonder if the slight tremor that just ran through the First Amendment might be the precursor of greater earthquakes to come when the stakes are really high. So, what must we devise to make this media safer for individuals stubborn about protecting freedom and serving the truth? And what do we all, educators, administrators, legislators, and agitators, need to do to restore the disappearing diversity of media opinions? America had plenty of that in the early days, and I talk about it in the speech. But the hour is late, and I'm going to see that this speech gets published in its entirety so that we can get to the news. I just want to say a word about owners. We need owners like Joseph Pulitzer. When the one-time immigrant reporter for a German-language paper in St. Louis took over the New York World in 1883, he was already a millionaire in the making. But here's his recommended short platform for politicians. This was the agenda of the paper. One, tax luxuries. Two, tax inheritances. Three, tax large incomes. 4, tax monopoly. 5, tax of privileged corporation. 6, a tariff for revenue. 7, reform the civil service. Punish corrupt officers. 9, punish vote buying. 10, punish employers who coerce their employees in elections. Can you imagine any of the media conglomerates publishing that as their agenda? The World certainly gave people plenty of his paper, The World, certainly gave people plenty of the spice they wanted, entertainment, sensation, earthy advice on living, but not at the expense of news that let them know who was on their side against the boodlers and the bosses. Nor did big time, big bucks, big town journalism extinguish the possibility of a reform-minded investigative journalism that took the name of muckraking during the Progressive Era. Those days of early last century saw a second great awakening of the democratic impulse. What brought it into being was a reaction against the social Darwinism and the unrestrained capitalist exploitation that is back in full force today as the policy of the United States government. Certain popular magazines made space for and profited by the work of such journalists, to name only a few: Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell, Upton Sinclair, Samuel Hopkins Adams, and David Graham Phillips. They ripped the veil from, among other things, the shame of the cities, the crimes of the trusts, the treason of the Senate, and the villainies of those who sold tainted meat and poisonous medicines. And why were they given those opportunities? Because in the words of Samuel McClure, the owner of McClure's magazine, when special interests defy the law and flout the general welfare, there is a social debt incurred. And as he put it, we have to pay in the end, every one of us, and in the end, the sum total of the debt will be our liberty. Can you imagine Eisner, Moonves, Wright, or Murdoch saying that today? I have a lot more to say. The hour is late. And I will publish this on the internet. I'm going to skip my policy recommendations and let you deal with those tomorrow. I do want to say a final word about my fellow journalists. We need journalists who come out with a strong sense of public service, graduates who are perhaps a little more hard-boiled and street-smart than the present crop, although that's hard to teach. Thanks to the high cost of education, we get very few recruits from the ranks of those who do the world's unglamorous and low-paid work. But I was a one-time cub in a very small town in East Texas, and I cherish what H.L. Mencken said about being a young Baltimore reporter 100 years ago. I was at large, he wrote, in a wicked seaport of 500,000 people with a front seat at every public show. By all orthodox cultural standards, I probably reached my all-time low, for the heavy reading of my teens had been abandoned in favor of life itself. But it would be an exaggeration to say I was ignorant. For if I neglected the humanities, I must swing while laying in all the worldly wisdom of a police lieutenant, a bartender, a shyster lawyer, or a midwife. We need that kind of human touch in our newsrooms today. As for those professional association of editors, they might remember that in union there is strength. One journalist alone can extract from an employer a commitment to let editors and not accountants choose the appropriate subject matter for coverage. But what if news councils blew the whistle on shoddy or cowardly management? What if foundations gave magazines like Fair and the Columbia Journal Review the resources to spread their stories of journalistic bias, failure, or incompetence? What if entire editorial departments simply refused any longer to quote anonymous sources or give Kobe Bryant's trial more than the minimal space to press? Are there one stories planted by the Defense Department and impossible for alleged security reasons to verify? What if a professional association backed them to the hilt or required the same stance from all its members? It would take courage to confront powerful ownership that way, but not as much courage as is asked of those journalists in some countries who face the dungeon, the executioner, and the secret assassin. This may be in the domain of fantasy, what I wish for, and then again, maybe not. What I know to be real is that we are in for the fight of our lives. While I am not a romantic about democracy or journalism, I believe André Gide was onto something when he said that all things human given time go badly. Which is why the First Amendment is the most important part of our democratic society, because it means we can get up on the deck of the ship and grab the captain by the elbow and say, "That's an iceberg out there." I'm not a romantic about democracy or journalism, but I know this. Democracy and journalism are deeply linked in whatever chance we human beings have to redress our grievances, renew our politics, and reclaim our revolutionary ideals. Those are difficult tasks at any time. They're more difficult in a cynical age like this, when a deep and pervasive corruption has settled upon the American Republic. But too much is at stake for our spirits to flag. Earlier this week, the Library of Congress gave the first Kluge Lifetime Award in the Humanities to the Polish philosopher Leszek Kolakowski. To an interviewer, he said, "There is one freedom on which all other liberties depend, and that is freedom of expression, freedom of speech, of print. If this is taken away, no other freedom can exist, or at least it would soon be suppressed." I'm older than almost all of you in this fight, and am not likely to be around for the duration. But I take heart from the presence in this room tonight, unseen, of Peter Singer, Thomas Paine, the Muckrakers, Gladstone, all those heroes and heroines, celebrated or forgotten, who faced odds no less than ours and did not flinch. I take heart from your presence here. It's your fight now. Look around.